The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm John Connolly and I'm joined today by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Today, the Prime Minister announced a once-in-a-generation modernisation of the armed forces as part of the Integrated Defence Review, which will give around £16 billion to the army over the next 4 years. James, that's quite a bold claim from the Prime Minister there. Do you think that sort of once-in-a-generation modernisation sort of stacks up?
Well, I think we've got, with COVID, we got so used to kind of big numbers being thrown around, £12 billion for test and trace. But it is worth noting that this is significantly more money for defence than the government had promised, the Tory party had promised in its manifesto. And it's very unusual that governments end up on popular things like defence spending, end up spending more than they told the voters they would at the election. I think it reflects an attempt to fix this thing that has been around in politics. First started covering Westminster, 2006, the MOD black hole, which basically sucks money into the budget and all this. It's an attempt to fix that. It's an attempt to modernise the armed forces. We're in a very different world now. You have three quite different threats to the UK that exist in quite different spheres. So in China, you have something that we haven't had since the end of the Cold War, which is a classic great power rival threat to the UK. The UK's role in that is as a supportive power, as part of a kind of American-led coalition. But that obviously is going to cost money to deal with that. Then you have Russia, which I think is a threat that primarily exists in cyberspace, disinformation, all those kind of issues. And then you have the continuing terrorist threat. And because you are having to deal with three different threats that take place in three different theatres, that is obviously going to require more money. And I think that if you look at what Boris Johnson is saying today about restoring the UK as a kind of foremost naval power, I think there are some other political messages here. I think there's a message to the incoming US administration that the UK is still serious about defence. It's going to be the second biggest military spender in NATO. So let's have a good relationship. I think it's a subtle but implicit message to the Europeans that you have an interest in the success of the UK economy, because the UK is going to be spend serious money on the defence of the European continent and the wider Western world. And then I think if you look at when Boris Johnson was talking about shipbuilding, where are these ships going to be built? Lots of them are going to be built in Scotland. He has long been convinced, indeed he said this in an interview with KTI during the election campaign, that one of the ways he was going to bolster the union was to build more ships in Scotland. He thought that that kind of industrial strategy would have a good effect. And I think there is an interesting question here, which is the cost here is obviously the question. I do think there has been some interesting academic research in the US that shows that defence spending is a particularly effective form of fiscal stimulus, which is obviously going to be needed post-COVID. But I think the longer term issue is, can you solve these constant procurement problems in the MOD that created the black hole in the first place? Because if you can't do that, even this really significant amount of money isn't going to be enough to turn things around for good.
And James, you know, you mentioned the money there. Katie, there have been sort of reports leading up to the Integrated Defence Review that Rishi Sunak wasn't certainly happy with it, sort of wanted the spending taps to be, you know, closed shut rather than flung wide open. Do you think this is sort of a big sign that Boris Johnson's moving in an opposite direction to that at the moment?
Well, I think in a spending review, you have battles, the Treasury versus Number 10 and versus departments and those. And it's not so much a general, oh, they've lost the war, so much as, you know, there'll be battles they lose, battles they win. I think that you're looking at this, despite the fact that Rishi Sunak has today shared a graphic with his own signature on. This is not a Rishi Sunak win. I think if you look at some of the first conversations, this is a victory for Ben Wallace and the MOD in terms of what they've got, because the Treasury are very keen to just have one year spending reviews, and I think there was a sense that they thought the Prime Minister had agreed to that, and in this case there was an exception to it because this is a 4 year settlement in terms of spending. So I don't think this is what the Treasury would have initially planned. At the same time, I don't think you ever get exactly what you want, so you can overread into it. I think what is going to be more interesting from my perspective now, in terms of for looking at the dynamics behind it, is if you look at international aid, foreign aid and spending, it does seem that one of the conversations going on around this was the idea that, yes, we can do this big funding announcement for the MOD, but in turn, we do need to save money somewhere. So something the Treasury are quite keen on is reducing international aid from, you know, 0.7 to 0.5 for 1 year in light of coronavirus. And therefore, in doing that, you would save some money which they can spend on issues raised by coronavirus. And now, since news of that broke and Boris Johnson refused to rule that out as something he might do, you've seen a backlash from Tory MPs, also former prime ministers such as David Cameron, who've come out and said this. And I think that what it builds up to in terms of a picture is Boris Johnson going to hold firm on this? Because it's not announced yet, or are all these Tory MPs now lobbying him, saying it goes against the spirit of being internationalist, going to win? I think that will tell us, given that I think the Treasury have been fairly firm in trying to get this through, you know, which side is holding the most influence right now.
Mm. And do you think spending more money on defence has made that more difficult, James, to sort of cut the aid budget?
No, I think it makes it easier to cut the aid budget. This was Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary under Theresa May's idea. You could sell that the combined defence and DFID budget as a kind of global Britain budget and say to people, for example, Jeremy Hunt, who used the question today to push for 0.7, you can say, look, we are spending this extra money on defence, we need to do this. To my mind, I think the challenge on international development is this. If this was a UK-only economic crisis, the argument would be easier to make, which is, you know, we've had this awful year in economic terms, kind of worst in 200 years or 300 years. I think as the FT says today, is it three? I think it's 300 years. We are temporarily pausing 0.7. The problem is, this is obviously not a good year for anywhere in the world. I personally think that you can actually make an argument that you can do this temporary pause, but and look at all the things that the UK has done with the Vaccines Alliance and the like that will help the developing world. And also the other fact is this, frankly, if this Oxford vaccine comes off, that would be the cheapest vaccine on the market. I think I'm right in saying that, to my mind, is for the developing world, is worth more than a whole bunch of other UK aid spending. If this Oxford vaccine comes off, you know, and there are some encouraging signs today, that would be a greater contribution to the global good than spending 0.7% on international development. So I think you have to kind of see this in the round. But there's undoubtedly, it is a question that Katie Brooke raises totally the right point, which is the issue here is how much is the Tory party prepared to face up to hard choices, or how much is it the kind of diner in the restaurant who went off, would you like ice cream or pecan pie or cheesecakes? Well, I'll have all of those. And that is the question, which is, you know, are they prepared to accept that spending more money on defence means that there is going to be less money for something else?
Yeah. And Katie, we had some good news from the Oxford vaccine today, didn't we?
Yeah, so after, you know, weeks of announcements from Pfizer and Moderna, we have had the Oxford coronavirus vaccine announcement. Not quite the same, but what they've said is it shows a strong immune response in adults in their 60s and 70s, and this is raising hopes that it can protect age groups most at risk from the virus. Now, the researchers say the Lancet Phase 2 findings are based on 560 healthy adult volunteers, and they're encouraging. I think we're still some way to go in terms of the full phase three, getting to the point that we know the effectiveness in terms of the percentage, because if you look at how many people it protects or the percentage it protects, Pfizer would have, I think, you know, 90%, others saying they're now 95%. The general expectation, I think, as we've previously said in this podcast, is it's going to be more like 70%, so a little bit lower. But I think that for the UK government, if they can get in a position where the Oxford vaccine is approved and it's okay, I think that does drastically transform the country's fortunes, because you go from a situation where we have a limited number of a really effective vaccine coming in, the Pfizer vaccine, which is not going to do everyone. It might, at a stretch, do everyone over 55. Can't do all the maths of population demographics right now. But you could have a situation where the most vulnerable are going to get it. But that raises questions about, well, can everyone else go and live? Or are they going to still have restrictions? If you can get the Oxford vaccine approved too, then I think all of a sudden, because we have so many doses of that, you can see a situation where they can vaccinate pretty much everybody in the country who wants to, and they can prioritise the most effective vaccines for those who are the most vulnerable.
And on other less positive coronavirus news, the Brexit negotiations were held up once again after a member of Michel Barnier's team caught coronavirus. James, is this going to be quite damaging for the talks, do you think, or a bit of a minor setback?
I think it poses some logistical challenges. I think it's particularly because time is becoming one of the big issues, one of the big dangers that talks get timed out. So obviously having to work out what to do when someone tests positive for COVID, and the talks are trying to shuttle between Brussels and London, which obviously have two separate sets of rules on how to handle COVID and isolation, is not easy. I think it's worth remembering there was a kind of spasm of optimism this morning because Michel Barnier has decided not to put off a meeting to tell representatives of the EU member states how he thought things were going, which was seen as a positive sign. It's one of those things, you know, the less they want to talk about the negotiations, the better they are going, is the rough rule of thumb here. But, you know, we still wait to see. I still think it is highly likely that if there is going to be a deal, you will need a kind of political shove from a bit more Boris Johnson, Ursula von der Leyen discussion, maybe even some kind of nation state on the EU side discussions to kind of persuade people to accept certain compromises. We wait to see, but it certainly poses an additional timing and logistical challenge to these talks.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening.